Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the show. I've got a great guest with me today, Jen Sidorova. She's a Young Voices contributor and a policy analyst at the Reason Foundation. Jen, thanks for coming on the show.
Good to be here.
So I had you on today to talk about the CDC's eviction moratorium, which is a wonky, kind of obscure policy, but it's affected millions of Americans' lives. First, can you just explain to us what this policy is? It was implemented just in this last spring when the coronavirus first struck by the Centers for Disease Control, but what just does it mean to have an eviction moratorium?
Sure. So eviction moratorium currently protects homeowners and tenants from being evicted because of non-payment on either their mortgages or just their rent. So there are a few eviction moratoriums going on. It's important to understand there's a difference between the one that ends on March 31st, which is just in 2 weeks. So that one was set by the Biden administration. It protects everyone from homeowner to a tenant. There's another one, also the national moratorium, that just protects homeowners, that goes all the way to May, and that protects homeowners from being evicted from their properties by the banks who own their property. And there's also a few state moratoriums. Like in New York, we have a all-encompassing moratorium for both homeowners and tenants for until June 1st. And some other, you know, municipalities and states have that, like Seattle, I know, has it going till June 30th. So yeah, but basically it protects people who can't pay for their housing from being evicted.
So let's talk through what exactly that means. Does the landlord just not get any money? Is it only if they can't pay, or what if they just don't?
Yeah, actually, if they don't want to pay, it protects them as well. So while CDC and I would say the government encourages people to pay if they can, they actually don't enforce it. They don't have a mechanism to enforce it. And as you might imagine, there is precedence of people abusing that. You know, we have a few in all around New York State. And in one of my pieces, I interviewed a few women landlords who had their properties basically being taken advantage of by tenants who refused to pay. Some of them, in quite a few cases, those people didn't even lose a job or anything. Nothing really happened. But because they're protected right now by this eviction moratorium, they can stay. So yeah, that was the situation that has been happening since March 21st of 2020. So it's going to be about a year in a week.
And What are landlords supposed to do? Have they just not been getting money from these tenants? They're just stiffed with the bill?
Right. So the eviction moratorium is not cancellation of rent. So tenants do still owe that rent. It's just it doesn't come due until you know the eviction moratorium expires, and it also they cannot be evicted obviously throughout this time. So it kind of the idea here was to prevent homelessness for about 40 million renters in the United States during this time. And the idea was also not to force people to live in very small quarters. But landlords right now are not really protected by anything. You know, whenever they do distribute kind of the Biden bucks or whatever, the refund.
Stimulus.
So should we call it? Stimulus, yes, that. Whenever they do that, they don't really stipulate for where should the money go. Like, and so the landlords, it's really up to the tenants whether they are going to pay or not. Yeah, there's no plan in the future. There's no plan for now. And really the landlords they've been left hanging throughout all of this. And honestly, the situation is even worse for, you know, small landlords. And about 40% of all their rental properties are owned by small landlords, which are mom and pop shops. And, you know, not being paid for a year, it's a huge hit for any family.
And yeah, you're actually a landlord, right? So can you tell us about your situation and how this has impacted you?
Yeah, definitely. You know, my story is a story of an immigrant, right? I came to this country when I was 18 years old. And one of the first places that I was able to call home was the area around Niagara Falls, around Buffalo. I made a friend at a camp, at a summer camp, and that girl just took me home for the rest of the summer. And that family became kind of like my host American family. And that's like that kind of that feeling, that what made me feel home in this country. So then now it's been like, you know, over 10 years now, but and my career took me places, but now I'm back. I decided in 2019, I decided to go back to Buffalo and build my home here. And so as many millennials, I wasn't able to afford a single family property, but what I chose to do instead, and what's actually pretty popular thing to do in Buffalo, is to buy a multifamily property and then live in one of the units and then rent out the rest. So I bought a 4-unit property. I got a mortgage, of course, and I was living in one and renting out the 3 rental units. And it's really like it's bigger than that, because for me, that's what for me is to make America great again, right? We take those neighborhoods in decline, we move in and we make them better. We renovate the properties, we make them both affordable for the community and just pleasant, right? And so I was on this path until the eviction moratorium. And now, you know, 2 of my tenants moved out. And for one of them, I actually had to give them money so they leave. I had to basically bail out my own property because they knew that they could stay and not pay. But yeah, they left now. And then the others moved out. I have one tenant that is still paying. But for the 2 units that are vacant, I'm actually not renting them out. And I think that's another problem, that a lot of landlords are going to hold their units because there's no way in hell I can afford supporting other people, especially because I also have to pay the utilities, right? And mm-hmm. keep up the properties. It's not just the mortgage. Yeah.
So this is interesting because the kind of traditional progressive narrative about things like this is that the renters are the poor and the workers, and the landlords are like the greedy 1% and big apartment complexes and mm-hmm. massive real estate groups. But I think the reality, from what I've seen, is that a lot of landlords or people who rent out a room or part of a home are just everyday Americans. Can you speak a little bit about, is it true that it's just rich 1% big business, or is it a lot more people like you than a person might think who are landlords?
In fact, individual investors, so small mom and pop shops, make up about 77% of all small building units. And they make, as I've already said, 40% of the total rental market. And but if you look like at the composition overall, it's about half of this country's rental properties, half of the landlords are small landlords. And you're right. We don't just share a house with these people, we share our home, right? This is something that we invested into. For a lot of us, this is a way for us to save for retirement. And it's also like, if you think of it, we're talking about investing into real estate. For a lot of people, this is something very basic they can invest to because it's simple, right? You don't have to have education or any sort of understanding of how investment works to be able to invest in real estate. That has been there for years, not just in America, like all over the world. It's so simple. It makes it, it's more affordable to invest in real estate than in, I would say traditionally just into stocks and whatever. Because it's been the American way for a long time. Again, you're right that a lot of small, and especially in communities like Buffalo, right? The community is in decline, you would say. Here in Buffalo, we have a lot of older houses that have been split into 2 units, or like mine, 4 units. So a lot of like younger people were doing that. Honestly, like my community, Buffalo, half of the city lives this way, right? They rent out maybe one floor or one unit of the house, and then they live in the rest. So I don't know how can people like Cuomo just have it in their heart to take away our investment, our retirement savings, thing that we've been building up or saving for so long, and just taking away our property rights. And if you think of it, something like that never even happened during the war or Great Depression or the Great Recession. Nothing like that. Like, people were never allowed to just live in housing for free. And when it's someone else's, like when it's private housing. And speaking to where the landlords in this, you know, the government has already ways of accommodating homelessness in a way. There is processes in out there for this. I'm not saying they're perfect, but there is a procedure, and even that was kind of. They don't even do that anymore. They threw the landlords under the bus.
Yeah, and this is an interesting question to me because the people doing this, it's just an unusual intervention. It's this very sweeping government intervention, but it's unusual because you think of like, okay, well, if the government wants to make sure people have food during COVID, they wouldn't say, all right, well, under law, now you're allowed to go to the grocery store, take whatever you want and not have to pay.
Yeah.
They would give people money so they could go buy groceries. So why on earth have they taken this backwards approach to the rental market instead of doing what would normally be done in government welfare programs and just paying rent for people?
Yeah, Brett, and what we're talking here is very, very fundamental. It's not even about housing. This is about property rights, about government protecting property rights. Like, for immigrants like me or for anyone, why do we even go to America? Because law works here and private properties are protected, right? We can start businesses and we can keep the money that we make, and like basic things like this. And what this is happening right now, it's happening kind of in the background. There's no major discussion of this in the news, but the fundamental American rights that undermine more, even more so fundamental American values are being questioned here. If you think of the, you know, examples of interventions like this and where they led, you can simply think of Venezuela, where right at the turn of, you know, early 2000s, rental markets were about 30% of all the housing options. Then they realized that there's shortage of rental markets. And so what they did, instead of cutting on regulations, what they did was they made it impossible for landlords to evict their tenants. Right now, the rental market in Venezuela is about 1%, because when you rent something out, it's impossible to get it back. Do we really want a situation like that here? We don't, but we're surely on the track to that. And there's other examples like this, like Germany, Berlin in particular, the housing prices went up. The real estate developers left the city because it just became impossible to really take possession of your property when you want it back. And then, I mean, in a way, this situation reminds me of, you know, Russian Revolution of the 1917, just like right around that time when the properties of the rich people were taken away. But now here, we don't even take properties of the rich. We just take everyone's properties and just throwing everybody under the bus. So it's kind of even worse than, you know, Russian Revolution. What do you think about that?
Yeah, wow, that's quite a bold statement, but I see where you're coming from. And I guess I know you're a policy analyst and not a lawyer. I'm not a lawyer either, but I'm left scratching my head and saying, how is this constitutional? Where does the CDC, for example, get the authority to unelected bureaucrats unilaterally impose something like this on the nation? And also, what about the takings clause of the Constitution? They're essentially seizing your property and not compensating you. I thought that was unconstitutional.
Brad, your intuition is exactly right, because right now in certain states, this is being, the CDC eviction moratorium is being overturned in the court. So now I'm blanking on where exactly that happened, but there were a few places just over the past couple of weeks that overturned eviction moratorium. They did deem it unconstitutional, which it obviously is. And I also would say that another kind of part to that is by mandating this sort of thing, you almost tell people like you lost any hope in the community. You know, as landlords, we need the tenants too. And, you know, I don't see how cities like Buffalo, any landlord would just kick out people in the street during the winter, especially like we have crazy winters too, or during the pandemic, right? We would definitely make some sort of a deal or some sort of, we would come to a compromise with our tenants. But what this is doing is just completely taking away any agency of any tenants, of any landlords, and is just telling us, you know, the certain way that we should behave. And then there's no way for discussion. There's no room left for anything like that, which I think that's even worse. Like I'm losing touch with my community because of that. And that's heartbreaking.
Well, and do you have any sense of how many landlords and people like you have been impacted on this? And any sense when this will end, these moratoriums?
Yeah, so about 18% of renters in America, so it's like 10 million or so, are behind on rent payments right now. So that kind of gives you an estimate of the fiscal impact of all of this. And the latest kind of assessment of what would be the total bill that the lenders will be on the hook for was about 22 billion. So that's how much money landlords would lose. But that assessment was already in August. So by my own assessment, which is built up on the fact that in January of this year, the average kind of tenant owed about 5,500 among the tenants who are behind on rent. So an average tenant owed 5,500 for their property. I think the impact would be like between 40 and 60 billion. That's my own calculation. And as of the sense when this will end, right now the eviction still stands. The national eviction moratorium stands to expire on March 31st. And I know that some states are right now removing the mask mandate. They're kind of going back to normal. And when that starts to happen, I am expecting people are going to go back to work. And then gradually we will see, you know, this regulation will go away. But the cancel rent movement, the fact that people were allowed to stay to live for free for a year, I think this moral hazard is not going away. And that I don't have a good answer for you to. I don't know where this is going to go, and I'm not optimistic.
Well, so will this leave some renters actually on the hook it seems to me they either have to continue this moratorium forever, which means basically mm-hmm. robbing people like you of your property, or there's going to be, whenever it's allowed to expire, a bunch of renters who are handed huge bills they owe, right?
Exactly. And there is no way, I don't see how we can smoothly transition to that. Obviously, it's not a rent cancellation, although there are movements like that. And Ilhan Omar, just last week on Thursday, she came up with a bill that was suggesting a rent cancellation up until April 2022. So if things like that, it's crazy that we even talk about this in this country. It's crazy that there's a politician who actually dares to come up out there and suggest something like this. But this is the trend that we are going. And again, okay, they're on the hook for that amount of money, but they were already given this time that they could live for free. I don't know, would they expect for this to continue, or would we somehow transition? I have no idea. Again, I'm not that optimistic, just because from my understanding of psychology that I have, and I have a master's degree in political psychology, these processes like this, when they unravel, they don't really end up. And once you give this idea, you put it in the heads of the people, it just kind of converges to even worse outcome.
Yeah, unfortunately, that is how big government and concentrated government power tend to work. Once they get their tentacles into something, they're not often willing to give it up. I do wonder, though, what kind of alternative, if anything, do you think the government could have done to make rent more affordable for people during the pandemic without having to resort to this kind of unconstitutional power grab?
Right. So I think first and foremost, people should have been allowed to work a lot sooner because, you know, there were people who were willing to work, they just couldn't. So that's number one thing. Then the cash flow would have just restored itself much faster. Secondly, I would give more power to the community. I would give more power to the municipalities and just look local governments into figuring out the situation. And honestly, I don't want to sound like a bad libertarian, but you know, colleges were closed for a whole year, and the state owns a lot of those college properties. So they are definitely well equipped for housing people. That could have been maybe a crazy idea, but one idea that I had in mind. But so the government was equipped. So there were many options that I saw for the government to go about it, but they took the path of least resistance. because I think one of the reasons for that was because the overall attitude towards entrepreneurship in this country has changed. In many ways, this is not the kind of America me or other immigrants like me signed up for. And that's why they felt comfortable doing this. I don't think a conversation, this would have even been a conversation 10 years ago.
Yeah, I certainly understand that sentiment. And one of the reasons that we have high rents in a lot of cities, and we have a supply problem. We have rent control laws and zoning regulations that limit the ability to create new housing supply. And this is basic economics. When you have a constrained supply, but increasing demand, prices go up. Do you think that this kind of eviction, putting landlords on notice that if you rent out your properties, well, we might come in and declare them, allowing people to occupy them without paying. Do you think that will, in the long run, discourage people from getting into becoming a landlord and reduce the supply of rental housing, making this whole problem worse?
Yes, as I've, and you're exactly right, because as I've already kind of alluded to that, I am holding off my rental properties because the worst thing is that they are being occupied and nobody and the tenants are not paying. And I think I'm also part of a lot of the Facebook groups for landlords and all of that. I talk to my
community landlords. You're leaving them just empty.
I'm leaving them empty. Yeah.
Wow. So this policy is literally encouraging landlords financial incentive to just leave apartments empty rather than rent them out.
Yeah, it's a better strategy for me to leave them empty than renting them out for no pay. It's just the risk. I cannot run this risk. In my property in particular, I also pay tenants utilities. So I would be on the hook for like not just the rent, but also utilities. And obviously I can't afford that. And then you still have to maintain them when they're being utilized. It's just the economics of it doesn't match up. The risk is so high. Nobody in, tenants who still pay the rent in New York, they have no economic incentive whatsoever to do this. So, I'm in touch with my community of landlords on Facebook groups and all of that. And a lot of them are doing the same. Smaller landlords are now exiting the market because it just doesn't make sense. And I know that you've mentioned rent control, which is obviously a big deal in New York City. I've lived in the New York City suburb for about 10 years, and I'm very familiar with that situation. You know, the situation is as crazy as I would have friends who had professional jobs or whatever. They would pay $3,500 for one bedroom apartment, and they would have a neighbor who would pay $800 for the same apartment just because they were rent controlled and they've lived there for a long time. And there's all sorts of like rent controls. They're all different types of rent controls in New York City. And they're definitely true and alive. And New York City is not the only one. So that's definitely adds to the price inflation to, they're basically, there's no place for young people in New York City. It's like they're kind of kicking young people out because of this policies like this, because of rent control, because who can afford $3,500 a month for one bedroom? And then as far as zoning regulations, that's definitely a different beast that has been affecting a lot of cities and a lot of suburban areas. I think these days there's so many businesses that really wouldn't put a lot of pressure on the residential areas or like urban city areas. There's so much potential for cities like Buffalo or like second tier cities that could completely revamp their main street for just removing certain regulations, certain zoning regulations. They can open more new businesses and they can make more smaller apartments, whatever. There's just so much potential. But, cities like Seattle, for instance, I know that realtors really avoid Seattle because it's just too many regulations and you cannot work with the city. And that's crazy because that area of the country is very pricey. And it's the same happening in San Francisco. And San Francisco bit New York City in pricing. San Francisco became actually more expensive than New York City. How can you do this? Because you have even crazier government with even crazy regulations.
So what do you think about the whole eviction moratorium debacle and the havoc it's wreaking on the housing sector? Do you think there's a bigger picture takeaway about big government and about the role of policymakers that people should see from this dysfunctional result?
Yeah, I do think a lot of people have been stripped of their agency by things like eviction moratorium because they were made to believe that landlords and entrepreneurs are bad people, that you cannot negotiate with them. And that has taken basically the desire to do something, to change something from people. For instance, someone like me who I've lived in New York City suburb for a long time, I couldn't afford anything there, but I knew like I could move, right? That's a drastic decision, right? Not everybody can move. But again, I took control of the situation that I was given in. And I think that would be a better lesson to teach young people. And that would be a better strategy for the government. In Buffalo, we had some incentives for people who came here. There were some, you know, Cuomo gave some startup money for new businesses in tech through the program called 43 North. And a lot of businesses came here this way. And one of the, but that's, I guess, I don't know if that's really that helpful to just throw money out at people. But the other program that they did in New York was the program where they would let you not pay state taxes as long as you move to the areas that needed improvement. So, or you work in those areas, something like that. I'm forgetting the name of the program, but I know that quite a few of the startups that I've worked with before becoming a policy analyst did that. So people could keep a little bit of their own money and not pay tax. So I guess just easing up on regulations, having faith in your community would be the way to get us out of this crisis. Letting people go back to work and stop mandating our relationships with, you know, either our landlords, tenants, or even how we, when can we see our families or activities that we can do. Stop doing that, and then gradually we can rebuild.
I think that is a good place to leave the analysis. If you want to find more of Jen's work, I will have the link to her Twitter and her Reason Foundation page in the bio. But to wrap up the show, Jen, we do this with every guest. What is your most controversial food opinion?
Well, that's a tough one. Well, my favorite American snack is peanut butter and jelly.
I love peanut butter and jelly. Oh, there's a but.
But I do feel like it's a weird combination because nuts and jello is something that I've never seen in any cuisine before. And a lot of my European friends have a problem with that.
That's funny.
I am questioning that combination, but I keep enjoying the sandwich itself.
Okay. Well, I like PB&Js, I will say. And I think that is a take that will get some people interested. That's funny. I'm imagining Europeans trying to understand how Americans eat peanut butter and jelly. And I'm like, all right, Jen, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Brad.